Welcome to the continued podcast adventures of three opinionated guys with mics and too much free time. Strong enough to stop a speeding movie rumor, more powerful than a bad comic book event. Able to waste hours of time asking stupid questions to people who have better things to do. It's Dave, Ben, and John. It's Superhero Speak.
Hey everyone, you're listening to Superhero Speak, and I'm your host Dave.
And John.
And this week, we are joined by a special guest. He is an artist, an independent comic book creator, currently working with Outpouring Comics. I just actually recently learned he got his start as an assistant to Rich Buckler, which we'll get into in a minute. And he leads a secret second life as the elf on the shelf. So everyone, please welcome John Orlando to the show. How you doing, sir?
Good. How we doing over there?
All right. So you're on the left coast, as it were. How's the weather out there?
Oh, it's not too bad. It's cool and rainy, you know. I'm just glad to be missing those New York winters.
you're not missing a winter because we're not having one over this side. It's like 60 degrees here. It's really weird.
Yeah, it is pretty warm. I was just looking on, you know, how Facebook gives you your Facebook memories, and the one that popped up today was 2 years ago today. I took my son sledding because it had snowed.
Right.
And then today it's like 60 degrees. I'm like, this is weird.
A little contrast there.
Yeah, just a little bit. Yeah. So you are originally from the East Coast. Are you originally from New York then?
Yes, I am, from Valley Stream.
Oh, okay.
Valley Stream, New York, on Long Island on the Queens border.
My grandmother's originally from Breezy Point, New York.
Oh, right. Queens, Rockaway Peninsula.
Yep. Yep.
And and as a little boy growing up in New York, was comics something you always wanted to do?
Well, something I was always interested in, I can tell you that. I was exposed to them. I wasn't too thrilled with my first exposure to them because my grandmother worked for Gold Key, and she gave me bags. Well, she worked for a distributor in Queens, and she'd bring me home bags of comics, like shopping bags. There was like a lot of kiddie comics and stuff in there. But the ones that stood out to me at first were like Torak, that sort of thing, Brothers of the Spear. And shortly after that, somebody gave me some Conan comics from, Roy Thomas and Buscema. And that got me very interested.
Wow.
That'll do it.
And then you started as a penciler?
As a penciler?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, you broke up a little.
Oh, I'm sorry. So you started out just doing pencils, and like I said, I just recently saw that did you work as an apprentice under Rich Buckler?
I worked with Rich Buckler. I had been a student of his.
Okay.
In 1994, and I kind of quit my job so I can keep up with the lessons because it was very important to me. He was an idol of mine when I was a kid. So, you know, this is a big deal. And invaluable, too. But when he heard I had quit my job, he said, well, come in and work at the studio. And when you get on your feet and you know what you're doing, or I don't have to erase what you're doing, you know, on the assistants, then I can start paying. So, you know, of course, I jumped on that.
Right. Yeah. He's actually, it's funny, he's always been a favorite artist of mine, too. One of the first comics I collected was Captain America, and I had a Captain America 355, which I think we believe was the first Captain America that he penciled. And when I got a chance to meet him, I brought the book to the convention, you know, for him to sign. And
that's cool.
Yeah, he was so excited when he got the book in his hand because he's like, "This was I always wanted to do Captain America. They finally give me an assignment to do the book." And in the story, Captain America gets hit with this ray that turns him into a kid. So he's like, I got to draw Captain America for 3 pages, and then I had to draw a kid for the rest of the book.
Oh my God, that's funny.
Yeah, so it was a fun story. And then, you know, he says hi to me. We say hi to each other whenever because I go to a lot of conventions. Really nice guy.
He's a great guy.
Yeah.
It was great working with him. I'll tell you, we worked, just a few feet away from each other for a few years there. And, full days, 12 o'clock in the, 12 noon to like 8 or 10 o'clock at night, just pounding out sometimes 3 different books at a time. it wasn't just me and him, of course. There were other members, his son, Rick, fellow named Nasser Sabashi, and Winston Blakely, and there were a few others.
Cool. And then, so what kind of, what books did you work on while you were working with it?
When I came in there, when I first started with him, he was doing a three-issue arc of Siphons. It was called the Stargaze Stratagem for Now Comics.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be one of the first. The first thing I ever drew in a comic book that got published was an explosion in a small panel in Siphons number 2.
Okay.
Michael Bay's comics.
Most of it got covered over in, in captions, too. I couldn't even find it. I went through the book like 5 times when it came out on my little explosion panel.
Right, right.
There are a few other things that came in that book, but that was the first one, so that was the first one I looked for. We're also working on something that it's a shame it didn't take off. From the company was out of Texas, and they kind of canceled the project after we did a great deal of work on it called Zanaan, Z-A-N-A-A-N, I believe, and they were called Mainstream Comics. That would have been great if that came out. Rich was doing some amazing work on that. He might have some stuff. I don't know. You'd have to ask him about Zanaan.
Okay.
But it was beautiful work. I really enjoyed working with him on that.
Cool. Do you remember what the story was about?
Some society, sort of a oppressed future society where they don't realize they're oppressed and they know there's more kind of a thing. And the main character was Zanaan. And I do remember him wearing armor and flying quite a bit and him kind of stirring up the pot and starting sort of a revolution of thought in that society, something along those lines.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It's a long time ago. It's over 20 years ago. So I'm trying to remember it.
Right, right. Okay. And then what was the... So, I mean, obviously, then that never saw the light of day, never got published, or?
Never saw the light of day. There was some beautiful work. I know his son, Rick, who did great techno, future, heavy metal style cityscapes and stuff. He did some amazing stuff in there, and the machines, and Rich's figures, and we all felt like, very privileged to be working on this book with him. It never saw the light of day. He might, I don't think it saw the light of day, as far as I know. I mean, if it did, I'd love a copy of it. But Rich might not. I mean, you do see him once in a while. He might be able to fill you in better.
Okay. I will.
I'm doing stuff at Techno Comics after that.
So. Okay.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. I mean, I will definitely have to ask him about that next time I see him. And then you worked on Journey into Madness and Cybergen?
Yeah, those were the first two. They were released simultaneously. That was about 2 years after I joined the studio. Those were my first two solo books.
Oh, okay.
So there was a bit of inking going on from other members of the studio in Cybergen and some stuff from Rick and Journey. They were basically the first two books that I was in charge of, the penciling and the writing and the whole deal. And that was through the Cry for Dawn or CFD publishing mark at the time.
Okay. So when you say solo book, are you, do you mean just penciling it solo or were you also writing the books?
Oh, I wrote them.
Okay.
Nice.
And
how was it doing the writing? I mean, was that like the first thing that you started with for writing and doing the artwork as well, or?
I'm trying to think. That's fine. Journey into Madness and Cybergen. Definitely Cybergen was the first thing that I wrote that got published in comic form. Yeah, definitely.
Did you want to do the writing, or was it something where they said, hey, we've got this comic. Could you do it, please?
No, I wanted to do the writing. It was actually my idea, the whole thing. It was my creation, and it was supposed to have been published in 3 in color initially. And they put a lot of work into coloring pages. That didn't happen. There was a publisher out of Buffalo, and Rich's studio is called Visage Studios. And the book, he wanted to release a book called Visages, and there would be 8-page installments, 5 stories in each issue of it was a run of 3. It was supposed to be, and then Rich would have his story in there. I would have my story in there. Rick would have his. Nasser would have his story. Winston Blakely had Positron, stuff like that. And then after we did a lot of work on it, the guy kind of, I don't know, he disappeared on us.
Hmm.
And the title didn't have a home.
Hmm.
So what we did is one night I was dropping some assignments off that we did at the studio for at Joe Monk's place for CFD. You know, his work for hire stuff, pinups and pages for their lingerie books and their, that sort of thing. We used to do covers for them and so forth. I was dropping some work off with him one night. We lived in the same town. He was out of Valley Stream, so I could walk to his house. And I was kind of complaining about, you know, we did all this work on this book, the guy disappeared, and Joe Monk said to me, well, you know, your three installments equal 24 pages, why don't I just do it in black and white and give it its own title? I said, well, that sounds good, but I have another idea, too. I told him about Journey, and, you know, I was quite surprised. He said, yeah, I'll do that one, too. And that's how they wound up getting released at the same time.
Cool. You know, I mean, it's funny that, you know, you're saying a guy disappeared, but I'm assuming this was, like, mid to late 90s?
96.
Yeah, okay. I mean, because I've heard stories like that before, too, with a lot of little publishers just kind of, like, disappearing here and there. And, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We even hear that with the indie guys these days. It's hard to find people that stick with you. And, you know, we've heard other indie guys before.
You sort of brace yourself. You'll invest. You're still willing to invest in doing something with somebody because, you know, it could be worth it if you don't do anything. Nothing ventured, nothing gained, of course. But there's always lurking in the back of your mind while you're investing in it that something could, you know, just kind of disappear on you.
Right.
That does happen with independent stuff, of course. I mean, it's a very, it's not what it was in the 80s and early 90s. A lot of the comic stores that I had gone to, the black and white sort of independent books were dominating the stands
at
the time. People loved them. People were buying them up. Like to see that happen again.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, that's that is something that's been missing, I think. You go, like, well, because, I mean, I understand it's the age of the internet. When people seriously want books anymore, they just kind of go to Amazon or eBay and buy what they're looking for. And it's, right. It's hard to even run a comic book shop anymore, but, you know, just find a local artist who's doing his own book and, you know, and sell a couple copies and, you know, put them in your store. What can it hurt? You know?
Right. Right. Well, CFD, I was glad they took an interest because they had a very strong presence on the stands in the independent and the black and white stuff. They had a very good relationship with Diamond, a very strong distribution through Diamond. They had good sales. So I was glad to, very relieved that my books got a home.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
And I didn't make money on them at the time, like I said, you know, like things were selling.
Right, yeah. I mean, because I remember Journey into Madness when that came out. And, you know, that was, that was definitely, I'm pretty sure that was in my local comic book shop. So
really?
Cool. Yeah. And then you did do some work for Marvel, right? But was it just the cards that
Marvel, directly through Marvel? No, it was Fleer, Fleer Marvel. I had done some, not that much. I did a Hawkeye card for the Marvel Vision cards, which everybody hated at the time anyway, because they were trying, you know, there's lots of gimmicks were running wild in the 90s with the card and with the novelty covers or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Embosses, foil stamps, spot gloss, anything, you know, laser, hologram covers, all kinds of things. And Marvel put out this set of cards with it. We pencilers were instructed to draw an extremely basic pencil diagram of the character.
Mm.
No rendering, no line weights, no, don't spot any blacks, no finishes of any kind. Don't, you know, keep your lines very uniform. Don't, no thick to thin, nothing like that. They didn't want anything too strong out of the pencil. And what they wanted to do was go ahead and try to pop it out on, you know, cheap looks and computer graphics they had back then. Probably the best they had, but it didn't look good.
Right.
And they embossed them on top of it to sort of give them this 3D computer animated look. They did not go over well. But we at the studio, we had done a few of them. That my image was used, I noticed it in the CVS one night on some X-Men game book and a Spider-Man game book. So that was kind of fun to notice it being used. Not that I saw any more money out of it from that, but
yeah,
they did use it, yeah.
Yeah, that's always the problem go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say also for Fleer, I did a whole bunch of baseball card backgrounds for their Metal Universe thing, which is also something I penciled the background, the computer, you know, do the computer graphics on. But I did interrupt you.
Oh, no, that's fine. Oh, and, yeah, that's funny. I don't ever think about the backgrounds on baseball cards being penciled.
Yeah, and my friend Rusty Gilligan, I don't know if you, I think, of course, you know him.
Yes,
I'm sure you know him.
He's been on the show, actually.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, great. You know, well. He was actually, he always looks out for everybody else, and he was great about this. He actually got the studio, connected the studio with that job for the baseball cards, and he asked them to please, for the first time, credit the artists on the actual card. So I was in the first crop of artists to be credited on the, you know, for, you know, background stuff anyway.
Right. Oh,
that... credited on the card. And Rich, too. Rich did some, and Rick, you know, everybody at the studio.
Oh, that's cool.
Did a great many of them. I think I must have done 12 or 15 of them myself.
Wow. No, that's cool. And what I was going to say was about the artist, the work for hire stuff. Like, you know, I hear those stories all the time, too, where it's, you know, you get paid for the initial piece of work, but then, oh, they just reuse that image 1,000 times for different things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and it's, you know, much different than, let's say, you create the character and he's used in a TV show, in a movie or whatever, and you might get a little bit of something for that.
Sure.
But, yeah, so, what are you doing now with App Pouring?
Well, App Pouring, they're re-releasing the books I did in the 90s, including the two we were talking about and the two that followed through CFD.
Okay.
The Cybergen Journey into Madness, The Intruder, and a book I did with Roy Thomas. We own it together, actually, called Doc Behemoth.
Okay. And go ahead, John.
But is Behemoth the one with the monster underneath New York, or was that another one I remember?
Well, there's two covers with monsters and a sort of a city escape. Doc Behemoth is the one where a big monster kind of shovel jaw on him like a backhoe or something, and he's hanging onto the Empire State Building, and we're looking at it from kind of a high perspective. There's helicopters around him. And The Intruder, he's kind of looming over a sort of less authentic-looking skyline. So kind of, there are two covers, monsters and a sort of an urban setting. Yeah, I don't know which one.
I'll have to go back. Go ahead.
And they're releasing them as the John Orlando collection, correct?
Right.
Okay. And is that something that people can pick up now, or?
Well, there's some stuff for sale. I know that Intruder and Journey into Madness are the first two they released. I had gotten copies of them, so they're definitely available. Nice looking copies that I got too. They have new covers. Kind of changed the covers. They didn't alter it. The original Journey into Madness had that red sort of Atlas horror comic cover with the green ghost guy in the cover, graveyard.
Mm-hmm.
Now this a different perspective of that, an alternate cover, which originally I had painted back in the 90s, was supposed to be for a second printing of Journey into Madness about, I don't know, a few months after the first one came out, but we didn't get to that because I kind of got more ideas for, I was kind of throwing myself into The Intruder at the time. So that didn't quite happen, but that's the cover, that's the alternate cover that's released on the Outpouring version now.
Okay, cool. So, well then, besides that, what else are you working on anything for yourself at this point?
For myself, I have a book that I started. I have a cover and a whole bunch of pages, and it's going to be a graphic novel, so it's probably got more pages to go. That's kind of on the back burner now because I'm doing a work for hire.
Oh.
Which I can't quite discuss right now because I signed a non-disclosure. But
okay.
But I am working on that, and hopefully getting around pretty soon to finishing the other book, my own book, which is called My Paranormal Life.
All right.
And I believe Outpouring has an interest in releasing that.
Can you at least
an autobiographical?
Can you at least tell us
what's that?
Can you at least tell us who you're doing the work for hire for?
I'm not supposed to say anything about anything.
Oh wow. Sounds like Marvel then.
I can tell you that it's not Marvel. How's that?
Oh, okay, okay.
Not Marvel. But
so go through the list.
Process of elimination.
Who else is it not?
Now do you enjoy doing the work for hire stuff?
I do. I do. It varies from page to page depending on communication and that sort of thing or who you're doing it with. Sometimes work for hire can be a very easy thing to do if it comes to pages. If you're working with, for me anyway, if you're working with a writer who gives me, that, you know, if you're familiar with the term the Marvel way, mm-hmm. the way they handle their books, I don't know if they do it now, but
right.
where the writer gives you a synopsis and allows the penciler to envision the scenes and spread them across the 24 pages or whatever, and then I can give it back and they script it, and then while they're doing that, I can ink it. It just makes it easier than for me than, say, trying to follow a script or a very rigid vision that a writer has where they're practically drawing it for you.
Right, right.
In words. I mean, you just kind of have to mechanically That's a little rougher. That's for me. Other people thrive in that environment. When I did Dr. Heem with the Lord, we did that Marvel Way thing. It was great. He faxed it a long time ago. He faxed it, not emailed it. Faxed me the synopsis, probably three pretty chunky paragraphs on a page. I just kind of laid it out, faxed it to him for approval. He said, great, and I'll do the finishes and the inks. And while I was doing that and sending him back that, he was scripting off of the layouts I had sent him, you know, the captions and the blown paper. I drew it. Then he was putting the words in their mouth and the descriptions. That, for me, that's the easiest way to work. We'd work for hire or a partnership of any kind. I usually prefer to write to be drawing something that I personally wrote.
Right. Yeah, no,
that's my favorite. I mean, to live in an ideal world, that's my favorite thing to do.
Yeah, yeah, and I definitely can understand that, you know, to have total control over of what you're creating. I mean, it's so funny that you mentioned having the writer dictate what to draw. I don't know if you've ever heard this before, but Grant Morrison, when he's working with an artist, he'll give him a general idea of what he's looking for, but like he actually draws out what he wants, but he never shows it to the artist. He draws it, and then when he gets it back, he compares it to what he drew to see if he likes it.
Oh my God! Well, okay. Yeah.
To see if he likes it better or worse, you know.
Wow. Wow, that could potentially lead to the writer being a cruel taskmaster as well.
Right.
I remember back in the passing comics around in the studio in the 90s, and it was, I think it was Bart Sears had drawn, Alan Moore was the writer. It was a series called The Violator. It was through Image.
Mm-hmm.
And they had published that Alan Moore actually would draw the pages and send them to Bart Sears, and then Bart Sears would redraw them. But clearly, when you compare them, they were not the same. I think basically Alan Moore is giving him a very detailed sort of, but still allowing it to be more of a springboard
right.
than anything else. I mean, he kind of like used his breakdowns, but you could tell it was definitely a vast difference between the execution of Alan Moore's art and Bart Sears' art. I thought that was interesting.
Right. Well, I mean, and... I don't know if you want to risk disappointing Alan Moore.
Yeah, I guess. Well, you know, you run out when you're doing anything creative with someone. There's always in the back of your mind you could disappoint them. It could be anybody. It could be some copy for a local dry cleaner. You know, that you're writing or you're doing art for, and of course you don't want to disappoint them. Artists, you know, they say the gardener toils to make his garden. Or most for thy pleasure, you know, you want people to like what you're doing.
Right.
Of course, you can't allow that to dictate what you do. You want to be natural, but you still want somebody to research something.
Right. And that was not to harp on it too much, that was the Violator books?
Yeah, it was the Violator. I believe it was, I could be wrong. Again, it was a long time ago, a couple of decades, but it was like a three-issue series of the Violator.
Yeah, no,
I'm pretty sure it was the...
Because I used to read that book, and I didn't realize Alan Moore had written that, so I have to go back through my collection when we're done here.
Yeah, you could that also might serve as a fact check for my margin of error too.
Well, I'm sure if we're wrong the internet will let us know.
Right.
That's what they're there for. So you know, to back up just a little bit, you had said that that Conan was one of the books that drew you in. What was it about the book that drew you into comics?
Just the frankness and the natural, the way Buscema handled his layouts was very cinematic and very dramatic.
Mm.
And it was definitely, as much as I had previously liked the Gold Key sort of barbarian sword sorcery, whatever type books like Torak and Brothers of the Spear, this was better. And Roy was writing, and so that was better.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty... sort of a jaded six-year-old, so like if something wasn't good, I kind of wasn't very quick to scoff at it, you know, little creep I was. But this was like, I could find no fault. This was really enthralling stuff. It's just a strange side note is they had actually belonged to the actor Steve Buscemi, who grew up in my area. He was a bit older than I was, but his mother worked with my mother and gave her his comic books to give me. And they were Conan, and they were just terrific. Also, Savage Tales number 3 was in that batch, the black and white magazine. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It was like one of those mature audience ones.
Mm-hmm.
And it was definitely not appropriate. I was 6, but I loved that. So it was just so well done. Very gritty. Very Marvel had a kind of a policy not to write down to the audience.
Right.
So there was some, you know, they could really get some meaty imagery in the words and in the themes. Just very good stuff.
Okay, cool.
And you got them from Steve Buscemi. That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So
too bad he didn't sign any of them.
Well, that was before he was Steve Buscemi, right? That we know.
No, he was sort of Steve. He was a much smaller, thinner, paler version of Steve Buscemi at the time. Yeah. He was probably about 14 at the time. I didn't know him well. We went swimming there one time, and he kind of like edged away from me because it was a creepy little six-year-old. It wasn't like we were great pals, but he was nice enough. But you know, people in that area in New York, there's this sort of ageist cliquishness. If you're a different age, if you're older or younger, we don't come up off to you.
Yeah, I remember.
Oh, that's right. You grew up in that area.
Yeah, I was in New York a lot, and I was in the Rockaways a lot.
Yeah, it's nicer.
Yeah, yeah. I miss Breezy, but yeah, it was a really rough place to grow up, especially the Rockaways up north a little bit until you get to the rich part.
Yeah,
but
there's a lot of weird social pressures in New York, strange tensions between people. It was pretty rough. Yeah, school, I had to learn how to throw a pretty good haymaker at a young age in Valley Stream, I got to say.
So you had to be Conan.
Yeah, I guess I could relate.
And
fight my way through elementary school every day.
So then I guess that's, you know, because I mean, looking at the books that you've worked on, and then you were influenced by Conan. I guess that's the kind of stories that you're drawn to, you know, the gritty, dark, you know, warrior type stories.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, that was like a gateway thing too, because I got very into all the superhero stuff too. Anything that said with that banner they had in the '70s, of course, that Marvel Comics group, caught my eye. And it was this great old fountain shop in the neighborhood where they had a huge, huge rack of comics.
Okay.
I started getting intrigued. The first time I heard of Rich was when I bought Fantastic Four number 159.
Okay.
And that was also probably the first time I noticed Roy and looked back and realized he was also writing those great comics. That was just such a good issue. I was hooked immediately, and that's one of the things that drew me to his art. In the first place was Fantastic Four. Those books were good too. They weren't as dark and gritty as Conan, but they were very frank and very mature in their themes, like considering, you know, the times. I liked that too. It felt like I was watching a movie.
Right, right.
Like a grown-up movie, even though it was superhero.
No, I mean, that's true. And it's funny that it's the Fantastic Four too, because that's the book that you know, Stan Lee wrote because he was tired of the way comics were being written, and he wanted to write something that,
absolutely,
that again, like you said, didn't talk down to the audience, didn't presume that the people reading the comic were idiots, and that had some continuity and was written in a style that he liked, not, you know, Superman flies in, punches the bad guy, and everyone's happy.
I'll save you, miss.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, yeah, that kind of stuff is stuff that would have kept me away from superhero comics. Obviously, Roy, he started with working as Stan's, I guess, assistant editor in probably around 64 or something like that. I know he started writing X-Men right away.
Yeah.
When he came in. He definitely carried that tradition over, and he even kind of brought it to new heights, I think, in the 70s. I think he started at the editor-in-chief in 69. He carried that through very well, very, very well, through all his comics. He hired writers that wrote that way too. Steve Gerber was great. Defenders back then, talk about adult themes and premises and mature stuff. That was some really good material.
Yes.
So anybody under his auspices was also reflecting his policy on this family.
Yeah, I mean, and it's interesting too, because with the Defenders, do you watch the Marvel Netflix shows?
No.
Oh.
I don't.
Well,
I have this sort of instinct to stay away from superhero film or television.
Well, I think you would enjoy them, the Daredevil and the Jessica Jones that just came out.
Yeah, especially sure the Jessica Jones, because mostly because it's you want grit. That's like, it is like chock full of grit. It's it's right. almost painful to watch sometimes. It's not your superhero yeah. comes to the rescue thing. Yeah.
I must have some kind of a prejudice toward it. I mean, you got to realize when I was a kid, anything with superheroes, like you had Super Friends, which was sort of this
right.
childish yeah. Justice League. Veteran. Yep, Super Friends. And then you had the Spider-Man TV show. Now, the contrast, I shied away from buying Spider-Man comics because of that show.
Oh.
And then I had gotten my hands on it. Yeah, yeah, and I got my hands on number, I think it was 139 or 129 with the Mind Worm, which took place in the Rockaways. that was a dark, I was like, holy mackerel, man, this is nothing like that kiddie TV show. This is serious. My parents would want to read this book. It's like a, again, like a grown-up movie, I was thinking.
Yeah.
My presence was born, and also we had that soap opera of the Incredible Hulk, which was fun in its way, but it was definitely not the time.
Right.
Yeah, it was kind of a innocent. They were all kind of innocent at that point. They were not. They were for American audiences. That's when they were bringing anime over from Japan and cleaning it before they showed our, you know, because our precious snowflakes probably couldn't handle that stuff. And...
right. Right.
Oh, yeah. It's so funny because my son watches a lot of anime now. He's 13.
Right.
But when he would first started watching the stuff, I was like, you know, these cartoons are very different in Japan before they bring them over. He's like, no. I'm like, yeah. In fact, sometimes they'll change a female character to a male character or vice versa. They'll make a female character a male character because the relationship they have, they don't want kids to see that, you know, because it's, let's say in Japan, it's two girls that get together, so they make one of them a guy,
right.
You know, and it's like, but that...
Right, they adjust it to their demographic, I guess. Yeah.
Right, right. It's like, but it's a very effeminate-looking guy. Don't you get it? So yeah.
Yeah, I think the anime that was available to me, like, in the late 60s when I was a very young child, it was like Kimba the White Lion. Can't imagine they changed that one too much. Speed Racer and Gigantor and things like that. That's what I remember. And later on, yeah, when I started to see more and more anime, especially when it was getting big in the 90s, it really goes in some pretty far out places. It's pretty wild.
Well, the 90s, you had, let's see, you had Akira, which kind of broke a whole bunch of rules and just, you know, it added a whole bunch of gore and started showing people what was really out there. And they didn't show that on TV, but it got out. I remember VH tapes being all over every con you went to that back then.
Wow. I remember that being largely spoken about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Right. But the reason I had brought up the Netflix series is because that eventually all the characters are going to put together in a version of the Defenders for Netflix. So, you know.
Oh.
Like Voltron.
So, I mean, and I was a fan of, I definitely have a huge chunk of my collection is the Defenders, and I like that book. So I'm kind of looking forward to it. I want to see what they do with it.
Yeah, I liked it a lot too. I was good. A lot. Sons of the Serpent and all of that.
I'm sorry, say that again?
Really good. The Sons of the Serpent story arc.
Oh, yes,
like
yes, 20 yes.
25 or something in New York. That was just, I couldn't believe the stuff I was saying. Like, wow, they write this and they sell this to kids. This is hardcore.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny, too, because, like, people who haven't read the book, and you can sit there and say, well, you know, it has Doctor Strange, Silver Surfer, and the Incredible Hulk all on the same team. And they're like, what? No way.
Yeah. The unlikely, real life's like that, too. You know, the unlikely alliances we form sometimes that you never pictured.
Yes. Yes. That's, you know, and I will say that it's funny. And I know I'm going off, I'm really going off on a tangent here, but we have yet to get the Incredible Hulk from the comics in any form of TV or movie or whatever. And I don't know why they insist on making him a mindless beast on TV. It's like, no, he could talk in the comic book. You know, he had a separate and distinct personality.
Yeah, he was a very, they kept messing with him in the comics. They changed him a lot in the beginning of the first, issues when the series got canceled in 62. I mean, he was sort of like, he didn't talk much, I think, in the first issue, and then he started talking like anyone else, just not particularly bright. And then later on, they started getting, you know, Hulk Smash, the sort of broken English, and then they changed it from gray to green in 62, and then in the, I guess, in the 90s or the 80s, they changed it back to gray, and he had a different personality, right. And he's just a very, very messed up character, yeah.
Right. So
there was something about when they turned him from gray to green, it wasn't because they were just messing with him, it was because something about the color contrast in the comics or something. Yeah.
It wasn't working on the palette. I do recall that. But again, that's another change. They seem to change him a lot. I mean, they changed pretty quickly and through a lot of stages, but basically by the mid-60s, he stayed that way for a very long time. You know?
Right. So I guess you don't go to a lot of the superhero movies then, huh? So I can't... I
haven't seen any of them.
Oh, wow. So I can't ask you next year which one you're looking more forward to, Civil War or Batman v Superman?
Well, not if you have an answer from a valid frame of reference, no. But maybe I'll catch up with some of them. You know, I saw that Sam Raimi Spider-Man one. My kids were younger at the time, quite a bit younger at the time. And I thought it was going to be a disaster, and I was thoroughly prepared to hate it. And it's actually pretty good. I did enjoy it, so I should probably give him another chance.
I think you should, yes.
Well, so going back to you.
Yes.
I mean, you've got this super secret, double secret type thing going on now, but I mean, I guess you enjoy writing, and are you still thinking of doing of other things that you want to do in the future? Or do you have a stock of notes ready for stories that you've got? You've written down
ideas stock? No, not really. I do have a book that one in progress. I know where it's going because it's autobiographical. That's the main thing I'm really looking forward to doing in the near future. As soon as I get my hands on that and do the rest of it, probably got about 25 pages done, penciled, camera ready. It's got black and white. I'm rendering it specifically for black and white. Oh. My contrast, you know, heavy line work, and very, very involved sort of thing, because I wanted to look very rich in the black and white for the atmosphere of the book. That's, right now, I can't see past that. Usually whenever I'm working on a project, I don't see past that. And as soon as I'm done, I come up with something else.
And that's My Paranormal Life. Is that the name of it?
My Paranormal Life, yeah. It's about a bunch of really weird, weird, weird experiences I've had in my life. And a lot of people asked me what was going on at the time for those years. And I just found myself telling the story over and over and over again until I said, the hell with this. I'm going to make this into a comic. And if anybody, you know, people could read the whole thing and I don't have to tell the story again. I'll just get it down in visuals. I actually got to start working on that in 2014. We were staying with Dana Crum. That was Rod Crum's first wife.
Mm-hmm.
And we were staying at a place for about 7 months up in the mountains in Mendocino County. It's pretty quiet up there, and there's not a lot going on. And her son, Adam Crum, was asking me about the stuff that I'm talking about. And the conversation would come up often. He was very intrigued. And then I said, oh, that's it. I was drawing it, and I started actually drawing it there. I drew most of the pages that I had. We drew on it at the Crum font.
Cool. Can you give us... just a little, I know you're tired of talking about it, just a little insight into it so, you know, people can understand why it's so important for you?
These were some pretty traumatic and dramatic experiences, and it's kind of like getting them off. Besides, you know, I'm kind of joking about telling the story over and over again, but this would be a really tangible way to get it off my chest. It would give me an air of finality now that it's all over. That's pretty much what's important to me. Plus, I drew a whole bunch of pages, and I hate to see them go to waste. Is that I gotta finish it, but it's more than that. Obviously, you have to be very driven to you know, anybody who does anything creative, you have to be very driven to do it. Otherwise, it's too much like work. So we do them because we have a need. The technique I'm using on this book and anything else autobiographical I've done is to recall it as though I'm telling the story. And when we tell a story conversationally, we try not to, you know, bore people or crump or repeat ourselves and just make it very clear, not over embellished, just as frankly and as plainly as it can be told. So what I do is, instead of writing it out, I don't want it to be stilted or anything like that. So I I'm actually drawing it as I'm recalling it. So I can't tell you what, I think I'm up to page 25. I can't tell you exactly what's going to fall on page 29. It depends on my next memory and what to write down and how to draw it out and how many pages it'll look good on. You know, page design is a big thing, so the photography, that kind of thing.
All right.
So it's kind of unfolding as I do it.
All right.
So I'm not too worried about over embellishing or setting stilted or anything like that.
Okay. Well, color me intrigued.
All right. It has a Facebook page if you want to take a few glances at it. It's just my paranormal life.
Okay. I'll take a look at it. Oh, is it the John Orlando artist? Is that where you have it?
That's one of my Facebook pages. I have that. I have one for my underground comic, which is spelled FHA-Q. I don't know how if you say it out loud, I'll probably be censored. I'm kind of sad by the comic.
Not on this show.
Not on this show. No, no.
And, what do you call it? My Paranormal Life has its own page.
Oh, okay.
It's a fledgling page. Since I only put some, I didn't want to be too expository on that page and give everything away. I got some swatches and a few pages in there.
Okay. We'll definitely check that out. Cool. And then, all right, so what is FAHQ about?
That is sort of like the underground comics of the 60s and 70s, if you're familiar with them.
Mm-hmm.
Except there's nothing too raunchy in it. Of course, the language in the book could be definitely, nothing worse than hearing a PG movie. Just, sort of, it's definitely uncensored language-wise. But there's nothing, there's no, like, a lot of those old undergrounds. There's a lot of hardcore drug use and explicit sex and nudity and that. There's nothing like that in it. It doesn't go in that direction. But it's basically satire or even a surreal telling or a parable telling of the things that drive you crazy in society and illustrations of that sort of thing, sociological torture.
Okay.
The pressures of today and how absurd existence could be. It's just that sort of thing. That ran four issues through JGM. That's Joe Martino's outfit before he was Red Anvil.
Oh, okay. Okay. Cool.
And he went out on a limb to publish those because he does he does superhero stuff.
Right, right.
For him to go out and put this sort of book, and, there's always a stigma to underground. They think it's going to be subversive and disgusting and foul or whatever they want to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of did take a risk, put it out, but he said it made him laugh, so he had a point. It's really just satire and comedy.
Right, right. What kind of...
surreal, too.
So then what kind of things in society drive you nuts?
Just about everything. And think about it. Just going to the store, what you could run into. I don't want to sound like Seinfeld and say it's about nothing, but it's about everyday life. Or sometimes I don't even know what it's about. I'll just allow myself to vent on paper in such a way, and I'll look back on it and say, oh, this is about this, or this is about that sort of interaction with people, or this sort of societal awkwardness.
All right.
Sort of a self-expression thing. It's really more like an art for art's sake sort of writing and drawing, but in a four-issue comic form.
Right. Yeah. I wish I could draw, because I would do a story about I take public transportation to work, and every once in a while, like, cell phones have made our lives so much easier, but have become so annoying at the same time. And there's this one woman every morning on the bus. She's on the phone talking to like a friend or something, and she's so loud. Like everyone on the bus can hear her conversation. And she's talking about things that maybe she shouldn't be saying out loud in public, And it's like, you're not having a private conversation. You're on a phone but in a public area, And
yeah. That could be, I could see that being handled very humorously in comic book form, yeah.
Yes. Maybe one day. So, so as we, kind of get near the end here, one thing we do like to always ask our guests is, what's one way that you measure success?
If I'm satisfied with what I did, that's my mark of success. Of course, we have to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
There's that. But even stuff for hire, anything like that, I feel I did it successfully if I'm satisfied with it. I'm pretty tough on myself. Then again, the things I'm looking for aren't exactly what other people are looking for when they draw. But if it's not bothering me and I'm not gritting my teeth over what I just did, then I feel successful at work in my execution of what I did. Also, the other part of success is I'd like to see everyone who does art for hire or their own creative art. I'd love to see everybody make some kind of a living from it, that would be great, because what it does is it allows you, not that it'd be, get a mercenary mentality, oh, if I'm going to draw a lot of money, but being paid adequately to live on from what you do creatively allows you the time to do it eventually.
Right.
It's not something that you're going to have to squeeze in at night if you're not too tired from your day job, or sacrifice what you want to do on the weekends just to live a normal life because you have to try to force yourself to be creative in that time frame. If it's what you do every day and it comes naturally and you're making a living off of it, I think that's the measure of success too. I've been there, I've been out of there, I've been up and I've been down. It's a quirky business, you know?
Yeah.
And it does help anyone if they can sustain themselves with their creativity. It allows them to just throw themselves into it. Take the Beatles, for example. They didn't want to do touring anymore. It was too much like work. And they did good music when they toured. But when they stopped touring, look how their creativity exploded.
Yeah, no, that is so true.
They were able to spend all day in the studio just poking and prodding at themselves. Well, what can we do with this? Or, you know, what can we do? You know, how can we make this sound? Or how about this song? You know, the album just became more and more intense, and the quality just went up, and it just allowed them to become that.
Right, right,
and they
exactly.
Were in a lot
right.
of ways.
Yeah, I mean, if it wasn't for that, we wouldn't have had Abbey Road and the White Album and so on and so forth. Definitely.
Oh, yeah, Revolver, Rubber, so you can go on, yeah.
Yeah.
Track by track.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, because you mentioned the Beatles, and they're one of my favorite bands. And one of the things I always found most fascinating, being a musician growing up and idolizing them, and always, you know, every musician wants to have that success when they're young and they're starting out. And but the one thing I always remember, their biggest hit was She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, Yeah. And
right.
They hated that song by the time they were done touring because they had to play it at every show because it was their biggest hit. Mm-hmm. You know, and like when you're a kid, you don't think about that. But as you get older and you're in bands and you're playing shows and stuff, it's like, yeah, I hate this song. I don't want to play it anymore. But
yeah,
you get trapped by your own success, you know.
Right. So that's why the other measure of success would be to make it where you could have free reign over what you're doing.
Right.
You'll do better. They just did better and better when the more they had that. That's definitely another measure of success, the freedom to pursue your vision and not, you know, be hammering out, she loves you, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right, right. And
not that hurt them too much, but
no. Well, that's true too. Yeah. Yes. And then the other thing is now I got a little to talk about. So when we normally sign off the podcast, I always say, don't let your cape get caught in the door. And recently in a print interview that we did on the website, our other co-host, Ben, who's not here tonight, said that the meaning of that is don't let your insecurities, foibles, or issues, you know, bring you down and get in your way.
Right.
And then he turned that into a question for the person that we interviewed. What would you consider your what are some things that you consider that might hold you back from achieving your success? And I brought that up in another interview, and he got upset for me for not actually asking the question. So I'm asking, what are some of the things you find in your that you know hold you back from your success or from achieving your goals?
The only thing that ever did was circumstances beyond my control. Just odd things from day-to-day life and survival. That's the only thing that would, circumstances beyond my control. If I'm in a stable time, things are good, I don't have to worry too much about anything, then I do my best work and my, you know, so circumstances would be beyond my control. Usually external. The only things that ever slowed me down from achieving what I wanted to do or achieving it the way I wanted to do it or even being able to get to it.
Right. Okay. That's a fair answer. Cool. All right. So as we're wrapping it up then, where can people find you online? What's the best way people can find you and you know, some of the stuff you've worked on?
If you go to my domain name, johnorlandoart.com, will bring you to one of my artist pages on Facebook. Facebook's a good way to find, speaking of pages, is Outpouring Comics and John Orlando at Outpouring Comics. You can find stuff there. And also the pages for FHA-Q and all of that. And it's been on examine.com. Robert Sodaro had done some pretty good articles and stuff regarding the subject of what I'm doing, and that's a good place to look around and, you know, learn stuff if anyone's curious.
Cool. All right. We'll definitely have all those links, in the description of our the episode, like we do every week. And if you don't have anything else to add, I think it's a good place to put a pin in it.
All right. Well, I certainly enjoyed it. I'm grateful for your having me.
Oh no, thank you for doing it.
It's our pleasure, really.
Yes. You know, if you ever want to come back on again, let us know. The door's always open.
Oh, that's great. Thank you. Sounds good.
All right, cool. All right, boys and girls. Well, on that note, as we say each and every week, don't let your cape get caught in the door. Have a good week.
Okay, now it's my turn.
Okay, what are you doing?
Taking over Dad's mic so I can be part of superhero speak. Duh.
Well, there are better ways to join the conversation.
Really? Like what?
Well, you can interact with them on Facebook, Twitter, Google+, and even Pinterest.
Wait, people use Pinterest? And what's Google+?
I don't know, something to do with circles. Anyway, you can also see all their posts, including comic book reviews, on their website, where you can also sign up for their mailing list.
Cool!
Yep, are you still going to try to hijack Dad's mic?
Nope, I'm going to try to answer the Stump the Geek question.
Nice. So who do you think would win in a fight between Rainbow Dash and Squirrel Girl?
Oh, that's a hard one. Oh no, Dad's waking up. Run for your lives!
Oh, what are you guys doing? That cape's gonna get caught in the door.